This is Vectis Radio. For the people, by the people.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Wit, Wisdom and Pratfalls with me, Joan Ellis, and a very special guest, as always, as they all are, Tim Callahan-Martin, a.k.a. King Stammers himself. Welcome, Tim.
Hello, Joan. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
That's a pleasure. And one of your other monikers that you go under is the Chunky Poet.
Yes. Well, it's more a sort of apt description of me, really. I have business cards that say, Chunky Poet has clipboard, will travel.
Are they chunky cards?
No, I'm missing a trick. I need to find someone that prints, like, nice, chunky business cards. So, ladies and gentlemen, listeners of Vectis Radio, if you do, in fact, print chunky business cards, now is the time to mercilessly plug your wares. I'm on the lookout.
I rather like the idea of them being printed on a piece of chunky chocolate.
Oh, that sounds delicious.
Mm, yeah, you like that too, don't you?
Oh, I kind of want chocolate now.
I'm sorry.
Goodness me.
I'm sorry. So when you're not, spinning the words, you're spinning the discs, aren't you? Because you're also a DJ.
Oh, thank you. That's a very generous description of what I do, I suppose. Generally, I turn up with a box of records and I play music at people. 99% of the time, it's music that people like to hear. I suppose I'm more of a selector, I suppose, which I know sounds awfully just pretentious and gregarious, but...
As in bow selector?
No. So more from sort of going back to Jamaican reggae culture.
Okay.
There used to be very much a culture of early sound systems where people would turn up and they'd play records. But this was before the whole idea of a DJ as to how we know it now, with two turntables and beat matching and scratching, before that came along. And it was just this idea of people just reaching into a bag of records and playing music that people wanted to hear. And I'm not the kind of person to... have any sort of technical aptitude at DJing. I've
seen you in action, Tim, and I think you're doing yourself a big disservice here.
Why, thank you very much. Your fiver's in the post.
Yeah, thank you. Is it one of those horrible oily old new ones? I don't like them. You can keep it. The Ventnor Fringe, we were both there, and you did a set at the Observatory one night.
Yes, Headfunk's Takeover.
It was fantastic. It was all lit up with fairy lights, and the vibe in there was just magical, wasn't it?
It's an incredible space.
Yeah.
Thank you, Jack and Rory, if you're listening, for facilitating that. It was such a good night. August is always a really interesting time of year for us, because... feels weird invoking this name in the studio, but regular listeners of Vectis Radio may very well remember a gentleman called Mr. Tom Headfunk, he would also run a night called Headfunk, and for a long time I was sort of his right hand man, along with a whole bunch of other people, but now that Tom has now departed, not in the mortal sense, I mean he now lives up in the Midlands, I've sort of been left the keys to the kingdom in a lot of ways when it comes to putting on Headfunk gigs. And that was, there's some nights where just all the elements of it come together. I know you'll know what I'm talking about. Mm. The with your show Dyed Blondes, there must be performances where things don't quite click, and then at the opposite end of that spectrum, there's events where just everything comes together in a wonderful way, and just everything about that night, the fact that we had like a really nice varied bill, everybody there wanted a good time, the drinks were fantastic, the atmosphere, the vibe, just the aesthetics of it, the harbour and the sun setting over the ocean.
And the moonlight later on in the evening, it was really magical, totally magical. And I was stone cold sober, but didn't stop me dancing on that circular bench in the middle like a...
It was inspirational.
Like a loon.
It was inspirational. You were pulling some fierce shapes.
Yeah, and there is, and I will send it to you, a horrific piece of film of me doing that that my husband did. And then when I caught him filming me, because I thought he was just taking a quick snapshot, but oh dear me, no, with his box brownie. No, he's suddenly got all technical and knows what he's doing, and he's doing a little video. And so I start gesticulating and turning the air very blue because I wasn't very happy. But anyway, so that's all captured and it's hideous. But it was a wonderful, brilliant night.
There is no such thing as hideousness when it comes to people having a good time, I feel. As long as you're not harming anyone, this is true.
No, it was brilliant. It was absolutely... I wish it was there all year round as a venue like that, because I know it'd be a bit cold in winter, but yeah, it's just wonderful. There's coats, there's jackets, we can make it work. There's whiskey.
Exactly. There's a festival out in the Austrian Alps called Snowbombing, where they build a rave inside of an igloo. They build this massive igloo specifically to have parties in.
Well, and they have these ice palaces, don't they? Where you go and drink vodka.
There we go. If we can rave inside of an igloo, I'm fairly certain we can rave in a harbour.
Have you ever raved inside of an igloo, Tim?
No. It's on the bucket list.
Okie dokie.
Hopefully by this time next year we can tick that one off the list, but we'll see what happens.
And what's the similarities between spinning the disc, because that would, you know, I'm happy to do the words and stand up and speak, but anything to do with kind of doing the disc and the music and all that techno stuff, what's the difference for you?
Interesting question. Well, for me, I approach it in very much the same way. Yeah, they're very different mediums, and you're working with very, very different textures. But fundamentally, it's still about entertaining an audience, and it's still about feeling a room and knowing what people want. I think we live in... I'm going to get really, really pretentious here, if I may.
For the second time in this interview.
Well...
You said it.
It's my hobby. It's fine. We live in this sort of hyper-saturated age of entertainment, I think. And I had a conversation with someone a couple of weeks ago about... because I'm sure you're aware of one of my best friends, Mr. Adam Gatchell.
Indeed.
Who also runs Spoken Word Nights on the island. And somebody was asking, jokingly, sort of tongue-in-cheek, do I consider Adam a rival in his night Cowspeak? Because I run a night called Reading Between the Lines. And not at all. I think very few people who arrange events in similar fields consider themselves rivals, especially in this day and age, because we live in this era where, thanks to things like Netflix and YouTube and iPlayer and all these on-demand services, you have the entirety of human creative endeavors about as far back as records began at your fingertips. I mean, I was watching something on YouTube the other day that there is archive footage that you can look up on YouTube of the very first audio recordings on Rack cylinders. Now, if you think about like 10, 15 years ago, if you wanted to hear those, you'd have to fly out to a research facility somewhere and hope that you could be granted the access and the privilege to listen to that material. The fact that that's now online and you can access it without even having to put on trousers, like you can just lie in bed and look it up on your smartphone, is simultaneously one of the most wonderful gifts for humanity and incredibly terrifying as a promoter. Because, you know, it used to be, if you wanted to be entertained of an evening, you'd have to, you know, get out of bed, put on trousers and go out.
Do you own any trousers, Tim?
I think I'm wearing some now.
Okay, but are they yours? Because you seem quite reluctant to put any on, so I'm just checking.
No, I'm
you don't have to borrow them every time you pop out.
Well... No. I would like it noted that I have multiple pairs of trousers. Okay. I'm doing very well at my day job at the moment. Thank you very much. I can afford a couple of pairs of trousers. I'm getting off point here. The thing is, we live in this day and age where you can access anything you want, and as I said, you know, it, say 10, 15, 20 years ago, if you wanted to be entertained, you'd have to go out and interact with people in a social environment. Now you can collapse on the sofa, order a Domino's, and you can stream the latest movies right into your living room. You literally do not have to make any effort.
But then that's the challenge, like you say, to get people off the sofa.
That's the thing.
And out to physically enjoy themselves with other people.
And it's the one bit of advice that I give whenever I'm working with younger performers in a workshop environment is to not forget that, because now more than ever, it is harder to combat that apathy, because we've all done it. Mm. We've all got home and it's pouring down with rain against the window and you think, oh, well, I could go out, but I'm comfortable now, maybe next time. And in this day and age, if people have consciously made the decision to come out and see you and engage with what you're doing, knowing that not just you have multiple options of things to do on a night out, but also that they could very easily just sit on the sofa and order in pizza and not go out at all. If you don't recognise that, I don't think you're doing your job as a performer.
Yeah, it's a sort of double compliment. It's a bigger compliment now, isn't it? Because like you say, the option to stay at home isn't a boring option.
It's not.
It's a very stimulating option. It just cuts out that sociable side of it, I guess.
Yeah.
And that live element.
Exactly.
Mm. So in terms of new work that you've been producing and writing, because you have a way with words.
Oh, thank you.
So I know your themes are love and loss and too much cider, apparently, you said. But if we can, you know, let's go for the love, because I think we've had a week with precious little love on show. So it would be really nice to give everybody a lift and hear some really loving words. Because you're in love, aren't you, at the moment?
I don't know if she can hear this.
Oh, I think she can.
Okay. I think I'm about to embarrass her very, very much. I do actually have a poem dedicated to the love of my life. And it's a very, very short one.
Okie dokie. And what's the love of your life's name? Are we allowed to know?
Her name is Amy.
Hello, Amy.
Hello.
This one's for you, apparently.
It's radically different from most of my other poems, but this is a very short one.
Okay.
In loving you, you are teaching me, finally, how to love myself. Thank you.
Oh, that's very nice. Now, what do you mean by that? Because people... This is something that is bandied about, and everybody says you've got to learn to love yourself, you know, the words of the great song, you know, greatest love of all and all that. So, coming from a Catholic background, when we were told kind of anything but love yourself, you know, always berate yourself and punish yourself, how, I find it really hard, I struggle with that one, love yourself. How, what does it mean for you, Tim?
See, you mentioned a Catholic background, I'm very much the same. I went to a Catholic school growing up, and though I don't necessarily think it's that in my own instance, as a disclaimer to anyone who hasn't been aware of me and what I do before, I do have a history of depression, and quite severe depression, and a lot of that stems from self-esteem. And I'm trying to think of how I can word this without going on for the next 3 hours, because I'm aware we have a time limit.
We have 45 minutes, but it's sad.
So I suppose what I'm trying to say with the poem is that we have a tendency as people to only see the worst aspects of us, that we don't see things... You know, we don't see ourselves objectively. And I know that I've certainly been very, very guilty of thinking very, very awful things about myself from time to time. And
worse things about yourself than you've thought about other people?
Oh, Lord, yes.
Okay.
Oh, Lord, yes. This is something that I've said numerous times, that there are things that I have said about myself in the privacy of my own kitchen at 2 a.m, that if I ever heard anyone say about my best friends. Oh, Lord, there'd be a world of trouble. And I think it's one of these things that when you have a mental health problem, it's difficult to forgive yourself. And it's difficult. And I don't want to say it's holding yourself to a higher standard than you hold other people, but yeah, you can't look past your flaws. And it's... And then you meet someone who sees things in you that you don't even see in yourself, and who can believe in you. And
do you not find yourself going, oh, what do they know? They're talking rubbish.
I would do, but goodness me, I'm trying to think of how to articulate this. I fear I might need more coffee before I attempt it. The best way I can articulate it is by saying that I wholeheartedly love and adore Amy. And it's not just that, I really respect and admire her as a human being and what she has accomplished. And ordinarily I would turn around and go, oh, you're talking nonsense, you don't really know. But she's an incredible judge of character. And for her to see something in me that... And it's not like... it's not something where it's trying to, like, there's no ulterior motive with it or anything like that. These are things that she sees. And that sort of makes me sit up and go, okay, well, she's right about everything else. I'm getting all flustered.
But if you were to take Amy out of the equation for a moment, heaven forbid, and it was just Tim again, would you carry that with you, that this kind of good feeling about yourself that Amy has given you, or would the fact that Amy was no longer around make you doubt yourself again? I'm getting a bit deep here, but I'm just interested.
Well, before I continue, I'm obliged to tell Amy that I love you to the ends of the earth, my darling, and you don't have to worry about that in any way, shape, or form. But that's an awfully big hypothetical.
No, I just wondered if that is now ingrained in you, or if it is purely that somebody else has kind of stamped it on you.
Honest question, I don't know. I think... The best thing I can say is that mental health is a process, and I'm not going to sit here and claim that I'm entirely cured of all of my ills and everything is fine. But each day is a progression. You know, Tuesday will be better than Monday, will be better than Sunday, will be better than Saturday.
And do you think your work, your writing, reflects how you feel at any one time? Do you think it's a sort of part therapy that you do it for?
Oh, of course. Yeah. It's undoubtedly. I make endless jokes during solo performances that I do this because it's the cheapest form of therapy you can get. And I know that sounds like a very glib comment, but it is true.
What piece of work do you attribute to helping you the most? Having produced it, you look back and think, yeah, that really did help me turn a corner.
There's numerous ones depending on the situation.
Okay. Have you got one that you could pull out of your bag, as in the old days, in true selector style?
Let's see. Goodness me, we're going back a little bit here. I need to double check that. No, I don't think there's any swearing in this. I think we're okay.
Just, if there is, just gloss over it. Do not swear. Please, okay. Do not swear.
No.
Thank you.
So this is one from a fair few years ago, after a friend of mine passed away. And a bit of a disclaimer for this one, that this one is dedicated to, like I say, somebody who passed away a few years ago now, actually. And I had real problems reconciling this person's passing because this was a person who spent his entire life living to put a smile on people's faces. He was a real jester. And I saw how the media sort of took this person who had a family and a girlfriend who loved him and friends and hopes and dreams, and they reduced this guy to a statistic. And I just started writing because I had no other way of processing in my mind everything that was going on in there at the time. So this is called Around the Sun.
Thank you.
Hello. Yeah, it's me. Sorry. Yeah, I've been sent here by the bloke upstairs to remind you that, yeah, we are all gonna die. And no, I'm not being facetious if you're wondering why I'm sat in front of this microphone being oh so morbid, but I'm lost on this idea of aging being something that's oh so sordid. I know I should act my age. I've now passed the point of 30, yet I dress like I'm off to a Mumford & Sons gig and my demeanour is far too flirty, but I'm okay with this. Because clocking up more days is a privilege denied to many. We only have a finite amount of time on this soil and our years are not ten a penny. And I'm sick of this media's obsession with living fast and dying young as if turning 76 is some kind of terrible fate with which to be stung. I don't know. Maybe it's just me. I've got so much to see and do, so many places to go and visit, so many scrapes to get into when we were forged into this world. From sawdust and sand. And for all I know, this life we live right here is the only one we live firsthand. I don't know. You know, maybe there is an afterlife. Something wondrous and pure in its divinity that justifies the strife, but why take that kind of risk when all is said and done? Because we don't clock up anywhere near enough hours orbiting that beautiful, precious little sun. So far, I've had 10,967 rotations of this Earth's axis. And I've tried to live each day true to myself, and I'm proud of this. And I can't help but feel it's time that, as a whole, we recontextualise how we think about growing old. Because when the bearded bloke upstairs finally drags me off this stage, if I've entertained some of you, then that's been a life worth its weight in gold.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And that's that's a very poignant note to end the first half on. So thank you, Tim, and thank you all very much for listening. And we'll be back with more wise words from King Stammers after this short break. Thank you.
Thank you.
Stay social and get in touch. Add us on Skype. It's vectis.radio. The World Wide Web never felt so local.
Hello and welcome back to this week's edition of Whitwisdom and Pratfalls with me, Joan Ellis, and King Simers himself.
Hello. Oh, goodness me, we're back. Oh.
A.K.A. Tim Callahan-Martin. Yeah, it's a very regal title, that, Kim, isn't it? So,
yeah.
King Stammers. Now,
there is a story.
There's a story. I knew there would be.
So, when I started, I was working in a high school as a science technician. And after my first gig, I'm not entirely sure, like, the course of events, but somehow it got brought up in a meeting that it was students were aware that I was performing, shall we say, risque material, comedically speaking.
What, in the classroom?
No. What I think happened is a student's older sibling was in the audience at a gig.
Ah, I see.
And the school were going, now, we're not going to tell you to not do this, but if you're going to carry on, can you do it under a pseudonym? And I needed a pseudonym anyway, because Tim Callahan Martin isn't going to fit on a poster. If I say it's Tim Martin, people are going to think I'm the bloke who owns Wetherspoons.
Wouldn't be a bad thing, would it?
I listen to a lot of reggae anyway, and I got thinking about there's a strong tradition in reggae of a slightly sort of self-deprecating title, The Prince Tubby is the one that comes to mind. You know,
did you
Prince Fatty? No. King Tubby is legendary. Jamaican
oh, it's not
radio.
You at all.
No. But
it's because you called yourself the Chunky Poet. You've sent me off down this line.
Cuddly Poet, I suppose, might be. I don't know. Part of it as well is a defence mechanism. Because I do have a nervous stammer. Well, when I started, I had a really bad nervous stammer.
Now, I've never heard you stammer, and I've watched you perform many times. You've been a guest on this show, I think, once before, at least once before. I've never heard you stammer, Tim.
Thank you.
So is that something you feel that the performing and has helped you with, or is it just something over time? What do you think that is? For anybody listening, perhaps dealing with that.
I think it's slightly... partly from column A, partly from column B. I think I do need to go on the disclaimer that I've got no formal training in this at all.
No,
I can't really speak with any kind of authority.
Just from your own personal experience.
From my own personal experiences. So my stammer is very much a nervous stammer.
When was it at its worst? When was the moment when you found yourself confronted with that and speech impediment, and then... you know, I just can't deal with this. I don't know when it's going to stop. I mean, I can't imagine what that feels like. That must be horrific.
So, I'm very lucky in the sense that mine was never overly debilitating.
Okay.
Mine was very much... it only really kicked in situations where I was very much out of my comfort zone. And in a way, by calling myself King Stammers... it's a very glib disclaimer, so that if I mess up on stage, people will go, why is he stammering? Oh, he's called King Stammers. That's why. There was an element of it being a defence mechanism in case things went wrong
on
stage.
And people half expecting it, and then it being okay if it happened, yeah. But was there a time when it wasn't okay, when you just thought, I'm never going to get over this?
So I remember... being at a day job, I'm not going to disclose which one for legal reasons, but I was in this very high pressure meeting, and there was a lot of responsibility that was being placed on my shoulders over this particular issue.
You weren't leader of the Tory party at the conference, were you?
Yes. Yes, I was.
I
with all of my card carrying Labour credentials, yes, I've been rumbled. I am in fact Theresa May. No. Oh God, no.
And another moniker for you.
It is an age-old joke with my friend Tom that I've had more aliases than Ronnie Cray at this point. So I've forgotten where
I'm
going with this.
No, I'm thinking I interrupted you. You were telling me you were at a day job, and it got overwhelming with the stuff.
Yeah, and I just descended into this pool of vowel sounds, and I couldn't escape it. If I can give a quick plug for something, actually, whilst we're on the subject of stammers, I can really recommend... sorry to hijack this for a plug for someone. October 22nd, over at Key Arts, there's a fantastic one-man show by a gentleman called Nye Russell Thompson, who performs under the name Stammermouth, called Just a Few Words. And in terms of, I suppose... it's been tagged with the whole sort of genre tag of disability theatre, but how you feel about that phrase, I don't know. It invokes different responses from different people. But it's a fantastic piece of work. I think it's the first spoken word show I've ever seen that has about 25 words in an hour-long show. It's very sparse, but it really brings you into the mind of someone who suffers from a stammer and how self-conscious you get about it and how you worry about people's reactions. In reality, I find people don't really mind too much. I was very lucky in that I had a lot of people who were very forgiving and very patient, but when you're in a room and you feel that you're holding back progress...
So you were in the room, and like you say, you were under a lot of pressure.
Yeah.
And I would imagine that every second in that situation for you feels like about an hour, doesn't it?
Oh yeah, because it just amplifies it. Mm. It's it just makes the original... Of course, if it's one of these things that's a nervous stammer and you feel that you're exasperating the situation for everyone in the room, it's only going to make you feel worse, which in turn will make the stammer worse, which makes the situation worse. And it's just this feedback loop.
So what do you want people to do in that situation? What's the ideal response for you when your stammer's sort of taken over you? What do you want people to do?
Well, I'm very lucky nowadays in that because I approached it head on with performing, because of course this is an entirely sensible thing to do, isn't it, when you've got a nervous stammer, is stand up in rooms full of complete strangers.
It's a really good idea, actually.
Yeah. But it helped me tackle my fear about it. But I think but the single
people listening in, if they're, you know, because we all think, oh, what do? We ignore it? Do we try and finish that person's sentence or the word? Or what do we do to help? What's the best response?
Be patient. Give them time.
And say nothing. Just wait. Or take the heat off them.
Yeah. Try to take the heat off the moment. It's horses for courses. Different people have different requirements or different responses for theirs. Like, I was always very happy when somebody made, I wouldn't say a pointed joke about it, but when there was humour, it diffused the situation.
Okay, yeah.
But then I know there's some people who are very sensitive about it. I know some people who are very, very happy when somebody finishes their sentence for them. And equally, I know other people who feel that that robs them of agency and that they're not being allowed to articulate their views on a particular subject, be it political or just what they want for lunch. It's horses for courses, and there is no one-size-fits-all solution, as with all these kind of situations,
I suppose. And, you know, I'm interested when, you know, you said fancy getting up and being a performer when you've got a stammer, but also perhaps some people listening will think, well, fancy getting up and performing when you feel quite, when you've got low self-esteem. You know, how do you get up in front of loads of people and say, hey, look at me, I'm going to entertain you for the next hour, when you don't feel perhaps that you have got the right, maybe, because your esteem is on the floor that particular evening. How those themes seem diametrically opposed. How did you sort of rationalise those two thoughts?
Well, weirdly, when I started my night reading between the lines, I had no intention of performing. I'd written for years. I've written as long as I can remember. Mostly over the course of my life, it's been scripts, short stories, flash fiction, that kind of thing. And there's always been poetry in there, but it wasn't really until I went to university and I got immersed in the spoken word scene up in London, and I absolutely fell in love with it, and I caught the bug big style and started writing poetry again whilst I was at uni, and we covered that in the last interview we had here. But in terms of the night, I didn't intend to be a big part of it. I intended to very much take a back seat, because the one thing I know I can do is I can put on a gig. I know that, I mean, getting people in through the door, that's a variable. I mean, we've had gigs before where everything's gone utterly fantastic, apart from the fact it rained. And because it rained, people just went, no, I'm not going to come out, it's raining.
Yeah. Or the sunshine can mean, no, we're not going in there, because we want to be outside having a nice drink and sitting on the beach or whatever.
But genuinely, I never ever intended to perform. What happened is, at the first night, with an hour's notice, someone pulled out. And I sort of went from being someone who was going to get up at the start and say a few words to, okay, I've now got to fill a 15-minute gap. So I did, and it went okay. And ever since then, I kind of got the bug.
And what would be your sort of pinnacle of achievement, if you like? What makes you feel really satisfied and happy in the spoken word gigs, for example? What do you want from them?
Well, as a performer, it's to resonate with the crowd.
And would you say that's
that could be any number of things?
And is that your ultimate goal, to resonate with the crowd, or do you want something more from it?
See, now it's a weird one. When I got into this, I had absolutely no expectations whatsoever. And then as it progressed, I sort of drew this bucket list of things that I'd like to achieve. And I've long since surpassed all of those goals. I've got so much further than I thought I ever would. And I don't mean that self-deprecatingly, but look, I should not have succeeded in this. All I am is a gobby kid from up north, and all of a sudden people started paying attention.
Liam Gallagher's the same.
Well, I mean, and I say this, do not get me wrong, I'm just one guy who performs on the South Coast. I am not John Cooper Clarke by any means.
Would you like to be somebody like John Cooper Clarke?
I'd love to, but I think to... I would love to, but being realistic about it. I mean, I get people all the time ribbing me, going, oh, so are you the best poet on the Isle of Wight then? I'm like, no, I'm not even the best poet at my night. Have you seen Adam Gatchell? Have you seen Doris Dulally? Have you seen Ivana Popov? Have you seen, you know, Richard Heaven and Catfish John? You know, there's any number of people on the island that...
I have to say, Donna Jones, MBE.
Exactly.
Take some beating.
There's this other amazing writer as well called Joan Ellis. Very genuinely, though, like, we could sit here for days. It is a real hotbed of talent down here.
Yes.
You know, there's...
Do you go off the island much, Tim?
Not as much as I would like. But occasionally, I used to make a trip over to Freeway Poets when I could, back in the day. That was a wonderful night and much missed. People's Front Room, I've been to a fair bit, though never as a performer, only ever sort of standing at the back, shuffling around nervously, drinking cider.
Okay, so have we got a poem that is inspired, in your words, you talk about love, loss and too much cider, so you've just brought cider back in.
Oh, goodness.
Have you got something cider-inspired?
Oh, I must do somewhere. Goodness me. It's finding ones that are suitable for this hour of the radio.
Well, you can always say sausages, can't you? And I'm sure that wouldn't affect the integrity of your work at all, Tim.
No. Goodness me, sorry. Do excuse me. This is a wonderful, wonderful bit of radio here, just me shuffling through pages.
Does Amy enjoy your poetry? I'm not talking about your love poems that you've dedicated to her, but your work in general. Is it something she supports you in? And
I'm extraordinarily blessed in that I have family and loved ones around me who are very, very supportive. I mean, I keep saying this all the time, that I have friends of mine who keep talking about how, you know, oh, you know, I don't really get on well with my mum. And I'm like, really? I don't have a problem. My mum's amazing.
That's lovely.
And very genuinely, I'm very, very blessed that I've got that around me, that just this wonderful supportive network.
And do you feel differently? Like, if Amy's at a gig, you can see her in the audience, do you feel differently to when she's not there? Or sort of life pre-Amy?
Yeah. Oh, Lord, yeah. I could be dying on my posterior and just looking at her, and I just get this rush again.
And that gives you confidence.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, brilliant.
Oh, yeah. So I have one. It's not about cider necessarily. Okay. It is about the after effects of cider. This is a very humorous tongue-in-cheek one. Please don't consider this to be a serious one. This is not my actual views about young people. This is one that was written whilst slightly hungover on a bus. It's called Breakdown in E Minor.
Love that title.
I am surrounded by school kids, and I feel so old. I look down at these hands of mine, and I see wrinkles I have never seen before. Age has decayed these hands. These hands that once seemed so young and so full of potential, now ebbing slowly into senility as they desperately claw and grope at the grains of sand that trickle through the hourglass without mercy. I look around at all these fresh-faced young people, listening to young music, smoking young vapes like a five-man terraforming squad, reconditioning the atmosphere into a cinnamon and licorice haze that knows no escape. The fog claims all souls eventually in this brave new world. They talk young hobbies. They compare young ephemera. The savagery of modernity has not yet been wrought upon them. Their faces still full of hope and optimism. I look around and realise maybe this is why some people take to drink. The barbarous finality of it all. First it starts with not understanding the cultural artefacts of the next generation, and then come the singular grey hairs and that long, slow, relentless descent into an uncaring and unflinching world of, no, Mr. Bus Driver! No, don't take away my whiskey! Daddy needs his medicine! Thank you.
You are talking my language, sir. I love that. I really do love that. Wait, because when does it happen? When do you suddenly think, my God, I'm old? Well, you know, other people frequently tell me.
I can tell you the exact point where I realised that I was hitting a particular age. So I have a poem called C90. Which is about cassette tapes and being the last of a particular age group to woo the object of my affections with a mixtape. And I was doing a gig at a students' union, and I stood at the front, and I used to carry a prop cassette tape around with me, and I went, who here remembers these? And I'd hold up a cassette tape, and there'd always be a bunch of drunken people somewhere in a crowd that go, hey, because nostalgia kicks in and absolutely, everyone's had a few pints, yes, by this point. And I'm stood in the student union, I go, who here remembers these? And it's just a sea of blank faces. And I have never felt so old.
Do you want to do that one for us now?
Yeah, okay. Scrolling back a little bit, yeah.
But I know, I know that feeling. But I think it's lovely that, you know, the cassette tape hasn't kind of come back, but the vinyl has.
Oh, and yeah.
And the cassette tape, I feel, never will.
it's kind of one of these things that, on the one hand, I am still one of those people that collect vinyl, because where I DJ, I tend to use vinyl.
Yeah.
But with cassette tapes, on the one hand, yes, they were terrible. But I also really miss the way that you could just pause it, remove it, and then come back to it later.
That's right. They were so simple, weren't they? They really were beautifully simple, apart from when the whole thing spooled out and you had to get your biro and flick it through.
You joke. Yeah. I wanted to create, because I brought out a CD a little while ago of some of my pieces, and I really liked the idea of creating like a spin-off of it that was recorded to cassette tape that came with a free pencil. And if you could tell me why you needed the pencil to go with the cassette tape, you got it for half price.
And you were very old.
You're only as old as you feel. You're only as old as you feel. So this is the one about the cassette tapes. It's called C90. Mate, what's going on with you and Susie? Is it serious? Lads, I've made her a mixtape. They all reply in shock, their mouths agape. A generation sonnets came with the warm fuzz of a C90, a 5,400 second long declaration of love that could make you feel so high and mighty. Two sides to play at DJ and a stratosphere of tunes from which to curate, although the quality of the six pack from Curry's was something to debate. And if they included some Nirvana, well, then I knew they were a keeper, because a mutual love of Kurt Cobain could only make her love so much deeper. And there's a part of me deep down that still thinks if you made me a mixtape, my heart would be yours. But if you are going to include any Jim Morrison, please make sure it's Early Doors. Cheers.
love it. So I've got to ask, because we've had so much about Amy on this show, and just a yes or no, have you made Amy a mixtape?
In a form.
Okay, that's a very enigmatic answer.
It's more that I sort of, you can't.
Is your whole life just one big mixtape?
In a way, yes. It's more that it's not really impractical now. Cars don't even come with cassette players anymore.
But you could have, you know, you could buy her one, and you know, just make the special tape, couldn't you? There's a little Christmas idea gift for you, Tim. Yeah. And what's your number one kind of soppy song?
Oh, goodness me. Oh. So I don't know that I can pin it down to, because it changes by the hour.
Sure.
But in terms of, there's an artist I can really recommend at the moment. a lot of the listeners may very well be aware of him, called Loyal Kana.
Sounds like he should be in the Jungle Book.
Well, he's this fantastic rapper from North London, and the phrase keep it real is bandied around a lot in hip-hop, but this is, he's the definition of keeping it real, in that he's true to himself, and right down to the fact that he's, I relate to him because he's a bloke from North London who raps about being perpetually skinned, and he talks about, you know, this is one of his tracks that literally just talks about how he misses being a student. And he misses his student loan, and he misses sitting in his student house. But there are some beautiful, beautiful songs on that album. Damselfly, in particular, I can really recommend.
Okay, what was his name again?
Loyal Kana.
Okay, no, it just sounds like, is it Shere Khan in the Jungle Book?
Ooh.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's a very, yeah, very regal name, isn't it, that he has there?
Yeah. Oh,
sounds lovely. Okay, and we're nearly out of time, and have you got a lovely, lovely last Tim Callahan Martin special to end on?
I do, actually. Let me scroll back. So I've got a couple here. This one is, this is a love poem from a little while ago. This is called The Nomad. I met a lady who wandered, and she described that as a calling. And with velvet eyes beneath obsidian skies, she invited me to walk beside her. I said, kiss me under your wide-brimmed hat of stars, and I promise to follow you through galaxies. She took my hand, and with abandon unplanned, we fell into it, like a daydream or a fever. In syncopated steps we trod, my mortal feet too slow for her. First a stumble, then a trip. Before too long, both feet would slip, and I would lay lonely in the dust of her stars. Nothing of that day remains, save for snapshots in my mind, of when I walked through the hollows between stars, round the rings of Saturn and moons of Mars, the time I fell for the lady who wandered. And this is a slightly more upbeat one. This one is about going to London and gigging in London, and I don't get to go to London anywhere near enough these days. But this is called Rush Hour. There is life on these streets. There is hustle and bustle and things to attend to. Under glass roof of Waterloo Sunrise, I lose count of all of the commuters. Those that are toing, those that are froing, those that flock hither, and those that flock yon. I stand, and I wait, and I take in this sensory overload. I pause, and in the balmy morning air, the Londoners look at me like I have lost my goddamn mind.
Do you think that there should be a poet laureate on the Isle of Wight?
Are we eligible for one? I thought you had to be a city to apply for a laureate.
But you know, our own version of.
I think. Well, yeah. I think we should. I think we're in line for it. I think we've got a large enough pool of candidates for it.
Yeah, it's because when I come to these spoken word gigs and I listen to people like you and listen to Donna and they say people like, you know, Ivana Popov and all the names you mentioned earlier on, and you hear them and you think, my goodness, this, like you say, huge pool of talent.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering where that's going, and I'd like to bring that to a much wider audience because I think those words deserve to be heard.
Thank you.
On a bigger stage. And so sort of island-wide, and I just thought, Poet Laureate, yeah, wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah.
It wouldn't have to be formal, our own kind of version.
I think we are slowly sort of escaping into a larger consciousness, though. I think when you look at, and I'm not going to speak for everyone here, but you know, there's a large contingent. I mean, you know, you and Donna, you're doing fringe festivals all across the UK, and Reading Between Lines, we've been very, very lucky to host and curate stuff at festivals all over the UK this year.
And you're doing, well, you're doing a big gig coming up on October 20th.
October 20th, yes. Yeah. Yes, yes, yes. Oh, yeah, I do need to plug this one mercilessly. We have Gecko on his UK album launch tour. And we've got support from Butterfly Culture and two ridiculously talented up-and-comers called Jazz Sim and Annie Johnson. And I was having this conversation with your friend Donna the other day. There is a really incredible crop of young female poets who are coming up, and these guys are leading the charge, and I cannot recommend them enough. It's £5 on the door. It's at Right Rock Bar, 20th of October. We've got DJ sets from Tony Walton, live art from James Jack, and it's going to be hosted by myself and my poetry wife, Mr. Adam Gattrell.
And the White Rock Bar is in Rye, isn't it?
Yes.
Just on the corner where the old dressing up shop used to be.
Yes. Yeah.
Super. So that's October the 20th, 7:30, £5 on the door to hear some great words and some lovely upcoming new talent and some established names. Super. Fantastic.
Thank you.
Gecko. Thank you. Yes, if you've got a really interesting night out, get off your tablets, get off your sofas, get off your bottoms.
Put down the Netflix.
And go.
Put trousers on.
Go out. Yes, put trousers on. definitely. So we are both putting our trousers on and we're going to go home now. So thank you so much for listening and thank you very, very much, King Stammers, for gracing me with your royal presence.
Thank you very, very much for having me, and thank you, Vectis Radio listeners, for listening. And
well, we're going FM on the 4th of November. Yes. Hey, 104.6. Yeah. So it's finally coming, all together. So thank you so much for listening. Have a super weekend. It's been an absolute joy being in your company. Hope you've enjoyed listening. Thank you. Bye-bye. www.vectisradio.com